Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
You're watching Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Now tonight, our guest is Dr. Kalaiarasu Perasamy. He's the director of the Institute of Clinical Research, which is the clinical research arm of the Health Ministry. Also one of the six research centers or research institutes under the National Institute of Health. Good evening, Dr. Kala. Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. We appreciate your time. But if we may begin our conversation tonight with a little bit more of an understanding of what the Institute of Clinical Research, the role of the Institute of Clinical Research. I mean, for those of us who aren't familiar with it, can you begin by explaining perhaps your scope of responsibility and that of the institutes within the public health response to the pandemic?
Well, thank you, Melissa, for that. And again, hi to Sharad. Again, thanks for having me on this show tonight. The realm of clinical research is a component of healthcare. What we tend to do, of course, is to undertake clinical research as well as investigations that help to define medical care, essentially. Now, within the NIH, as you described, there are six institutes. The Institute for Clinical Research, in fact, is the arm that looks at the conduct of many of these clinical trials, especially within the Ministry of Health hospitals. We have 36 clinical research centers. We are also in alignment with Clinical Research Malaysia, the arm of the industry-sponsored research that is facilitated through them. Now, the idea about clinical trials and clinical research can be essentially simplified into phases. So there are preclinical studies, of course, and this comes from very much laboratory work and academic work and investigators who indulge in all sort of chemicals, products, and vaccines included. Now, once it is ready for human trials, they will come into a phase one. And here you tend to have what we call a first in human type or early phase trial. This essentially looks at very, very small number of people to test to see if there are safety issues. The product then is then brought into a phase two trial where more people are tested, essentially is to establish this effectiveness. And then, of course, it's brought into human trial on a larger scale where thousands of people are involved. As you perhaps would have realized in the vaccine trial, to determine an efficacy, you would use something between 20,000 to 40,000 participants or volunteers. And then, of course, from that, it becomes used in the phase four, which is where public tend to be given vaccine or medication and so on and so forth. So phases of trials are determined by regulation and conduct through an ethical process, including, of course, regulations of who is able to undertake the trial. The role of the Institute for Clinical Research is to coordinate this among clinicians who will be, of course, from various segments, including, of course, infectious disease specialists. You have those who are surgeons, practitioners who are in rehab medicine, and so on and so forth. Likewise, we need to link with the monitoring systems, whereby there are trial monitors who are allowed to review these data for safety, efficacy reporting. We are also in the midst of course, looking at the protocol and ensuring that they all fit into the conduct a proper trial, which confirms to what we call the Good Clinical Practice Guidelines, GCP. So the Institute for Clinical Research takes the championship in this part of the Ministry of Health. And we are proud to, of course, be associated in many international studies as well. I hope that gives you a little bit on to what we tend to do.
Yeah, well, Dr. Kala, wonderful overview there. I do want to ask you, though, for many of us who, you know, over the last year and a half of the pandemic have been, I think, finally interested in the operations of some of these institutions and the work that you do. Could you explain a basic question is, why do these why does this research have to take place on a national level? If research is on a vaccine is done in Europe, Britain, or any other place, why does it have to be replicated here, considering that, well, we're all human beings and presumably our physiology is the same, and so our response to those drugs would be similar?
Yeah, thank you, Sharad. That's a very pertinent question. I think many do, in fact, inquire why is there a need to sometimes replicate. It's not really replicate. It's essentially to validate. Now, trials are conducted in many parts of the world, some in very controlled circumstances. The population, the ethnicity, the enrollment, the criteria for inclusion and exclusion are determined by clinical trial teams. Now, it'd be good if some of these trials are done simultaneously on a multinational level, whereby you share the protocol, you share the inclusion and exclusion criteria and how it is monitored. Unfortunately, many of these trials are not in that framework. And therefore, if you wish to undertake some form of acceptance of some of these results, then regulatory bodies look at this. For example, if you look at some of the vaccine trials, the follow-up period varies for some of those trials as far as safety and efficacy is concerned. Now, regulatory bodies determine certain time frames for this. For example, you want to wait at least 2 months after the last dose of the vaccine trial participant to determine the safety issues. Some of this data may not be available, and that is one point. The second point is there are geographical differences. There are also systemic differences whereby you may not have the full capacity to undertake similar trials. And therefore, a country like us, and many countries as well, they will validate some of these trials depending on the strength of the evidence and the regulatory requirement that is already complied before. So undertaking a trial is not new. It is necessary. It is also important to ensure whatever that we roll out in Malaysia has the quality and safety and efficacy criteria to meet the needs of the population.
I mean, I hear you on that point, Dr. Kalai. And some of the clinical trials can take, you know, not just weeks, but we're talking about months, especially when you're thinking about vaccines, for instance, or treatment protocols. Can I just ask you, though, on that point, are we, on the balance of things, are we being too cautious when it comes to looking at some of the timeframes of clinical research, considering that we are in the middle of a pandemic, the nature of the crisis, and taking into account, you know, limited global supply, so getting in line for the supply queue, and also the presence of, you know, very worrying new variants on the scene? Are we taking too much of a cautious approach given that we are in a time of crisis?
No, Melissa. I think we have to put into context how an approval process is undertaken. Essentially, it is the remit of the product holder to submit the trial documents, the necessary manufacturing documents, and everything that is related to the product to the National Pharmaceutical Regulatory Agency. They do have their own process to validate this. It doesn't mean that every vaccine or every therapeutic that is brought into Malaysia has to be trialed here. It is not a question in that effect. Where there is a lack of evidence, this is where sometimes trials are undertaken. Now, we have yet to see, repeating any vaccine trials here. We've taken new vaccine trials here. And this is to increase the knowledge and the acceptance of newer products. This has yet to be registered in the country, and many parts of the world have yet to use those vaccines. So that is where we are. So we undertake newer research. It's not to repeat, you know, what has already been approved, subject, of course, our National Pharmaceutical Regulatory Agency's approval. That is beyond my remit to comment because they do have their own standards, they do have their own criteria, and they take on expert opinion as well.
Dr. Kalai, what is the link between your institute and the ecosystem in which it exists and policymaking? Cabinet and ministers and those who actually set up policies for the country in terms of managing the pandemic with regard to vaccine therapeutics and such?
Right. So we do have experts within our institutes and we are linked to physicians and specialists within the hospital systems. Many of them are experts or subject matter experts in the field. Now, there are several cabinet level committees and we work with some of these committees. I'm sure you have heard about the JKJF. Here we report on the selection of vaccines, and how this occurs is we monitor the trial data that is made available either through publications or a submission to regulatory bodies. Now, in this pandemic, as you perhaps have highlighted, much of the data has in fact come out a little bit into the interim phase of the trials. So it takes a committee to validate and look at almost all this data to make the recommendations early. And of course, there are other considerations too. So our institute, we play a role in this together with the many other stakeholders in making these recommendations. And of course, this is based on scientific data and data that is made available through clinical trials. So we do have our links, and we look forward to all these submissions to us. Now, of course, this is not together with the National Pharmaceutical Regulatory Agency. They are an independent body. So, you know, we take on a different view of many of these things, and we can make suggestions and recommendations based on that.
Okay, very quickly, can we talk a little bit about some of the new clinical trials and some of the new vaccines that are coming online, Dr. Kalai? I understand, you know, I think about a month ago, it was announced that Malaysia is taking part of a new COVID-19 vaccine that was manufactured by China. It was supposed to take a few months. And we also hear of Sinopharm being the sixth vaccine that will be approved for conditional use within Malaysia. Can you talk a little bit about that and how fast we're moving on that track? Why is it important that we have multiple vaccines within our portfolio?
Right. So there are two things here. First is the role of the trial. So we do, of course, have a role to contribute to scientific knowledge. And we have undertaken a clinical trial on an inactivated form of a vaccine. There are many, very many vaccines in trial phase, of course, because there is still much to learn about the COVID-19 disease and how we can manage it effectively. And so that trial is ongoing. We recruited 3,000 healthy volunteers and a certain population of a certain age group. And we are into the interim phase, and soon we should be able to offer the trialists some forward thinking about what is this effectiveness and so on and so forth. Now, the other portfolios you mentioned are those vaccines that have been used in the country. They have taken through a route of a process of looking at the published data or trial data. This comes from many parts of the world. We have not taken part in those trials. And so we have to look at the data. And from what has been offered, we know some of the vaccines have very high efficacy in the trial. And the safety and the quality of the vaccines are acceptable. And so they're already being used. We know, for example, we use the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. We have used the AstraZeneca-Oxford vaccine. And we also use the Sinovac vaccine. All these vaccines are also registered or what we call given conditional approval under the WHO and many other regulatory bodies. Now, right. As you mentioned, Sinopharm, this is another platform that has come on board. It, in fact, has been given regulatory approval by WHO, and we anticipate that perhaps they will have a favorable opinion through our NPRA and our DCA.
All right, Dr. Kalai, there's still so much to discuss, but we're going to take a quick break. After this, we'll continue the conversation and touch on everything from variants to vaccines. So stay tuned to Consider This. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Let's continue our conversation with Dr. Kalai Arasupariasamy of the Institute for Clinical Research on the show tonight. Let's talk a little bit, Dr. Kalai, about how Malaysia is dealing with virus variants and the impact. Particularly, you know, I'm thinking about whether we have data and understanding about the particularly worrying Delta variant here in Malaysia within the local context. What are the yet unknowns about this particular virus variant?
Well, that's a huge question, Melissa. The unknowns are still yet to be, of course, fully investigated. But we know certainly that it has caused an upsurge in the cases, not only in Malaysia. You realize in Southeast Asia, not too long ago in India, then, of course, followed in UK. US and many parts of Asia. The Delta variant is, of course, among the various of concerns. Initially, I think it was discovered in India late December last year, and it created a massive upsurge in cases in India at that point in time onwards. Now, we recognize that there are some subtle or perhaps even real differences between the other variants, whereas the symptoms are perhaps looking a little bit different. There's more reported headaches and lesser of coughs and more of sore throats. And there's this perhaps looking at even diarrhea and so on and so forth. So the symptoms are beginning to look slightly different. There's also some report that they may not present like what it used to be with the other variants. Most of the other variants had very classical loss of smell, coughs, and you know, accompanied with fever. Now, the variants is also understood to have a very rapid spread, and there's much research on that. Recently, now this is all in pre-publications, and it is in fact indicating that the ability for this variant to transmit is very much, much higher. And in a high dense population, or where you have a population where they are close in living conditions, the spread is in fact much faster and much higher in the symptoms very early on. And that too is because it is thought that this variant sheds much earlier. Previously, it is recognized that the viral shedding, whereby, you know, you find the presence of the virus in the droplets much earlier in the Delta variants compared to the other variants, between 4 days to 6 days. Now, the problem with this is that many people are asymptomatic during this phase, and therefore there is every likelihood that they can spread. And by looking at the transmissibility between the variant that is the original and what is Delta now, it is in fact more than twofold to threefold. And this is perhaps why you see recently an uptick in the number of cases, and also the younger population being affected as well. And so there's still much more to learn about this variant, typically how it may respond to the vaccines available. There's some data, of course, that some of the vaccines are very effective, particularly when it comes to hospitalization and death. And the vaccines I mentioned earlier, the Pfizer and the AstraZeneca vaccine, seems to, in fact, I mean, they've got reports to say that between 88% to 90-something percent in being effective against symptomatic COVID and hospitalization. There's little data that has come through from some of the other portfolios, and I'm sure we will hear that. But overall, there is some indication that there is some reducer in the response of those who've been vaccinated, particularly those who have yet to complete the doses. And on that basis, you really need to emphasize the completion of the vaccination, the two doses that are recommended, and within the time frame, of course. And this has been much debated, essentially, whereby there are times where people have questioned, you know, the logic behind why there's now a need to shorten the schedule even. And part is because of the Delta variant. You want to give the population the maximum ability to defend themselves by being fully vaccinated. And if you look at the mRNA vaccine like Pfizer, it takes about 5 weeks for you to achieve that, meaning from the first dose to second dose is about 3 weeks, and 2 weeks after that. So it's about 5 weeks from your first dose if you complete your schedule. And so it's important that people understand to achieve the maximum ability to defend, they need to complete the two doses. There's much more we need to learn. I'm sure there is research that is being undertaken. We'll hear that, and I'm sure we'll share with you.
Dr. Kalai, I'm sure you're far too busy, reading the data and the scientific conversations that are happening globally. But there's also a local and more public chatter about many of the things that you talk about, with people taking positions on everything from ivermectin to, say, you know, mix and match strategies for. When you listen to the local conversations, the public conversations, are you concerned about the ways in which people think about scientific research, think about these, you know, public health measures, especially with regard to pharmaceuticals, what would your advice be to the layperson who does not have a medical or scientific background when thinking about these issues?
It's a tough call, Sharad, because, you know, we are in a situation where social media, in fact, overtakes us. Scientists, for long, they have relied on the publications through a peer review process. But sharing of information through the social media is, in fact, an automated process where just with the flexibility of your finger thumb, you get to participate in all this. Now, just on the question of mix and match, there is, of course, the two sides of the coin. One is when you hear of the better response, and this needs to be clarified. The response is by the immune response, not by efficacy against the disease. So when, you know, the conversation is about, well, you know, by mixing, you increase the immune response. And these are mostly through laboratory testing of those who have done that. It gives the impression, well, you should therefore push ahead and make a policy decision to mix it. But it is incumbent to understand that that's not how it works, simply because there are matters to consider. Who would benefit from this? What are the safety concerns? What are the long-term effects? Now, this takes time to understand, and we need to have robust data. And unfortunately, of course, science is always trying to do this in a systematic manner. You can't just take on anecdotal or sometimes small studies to bring the narrative across. On the issue of, say, the drugs or repurposed drug, it's the same issue. There's always been a struggle, really, to find something effective to treat. Everybody wants it. Everybody wants a drug that will help us, you know, mitigate this terrible pandemic. But there hasn't been one that is knocked on the door straight away. People have tried, and they are well-intended, of course. And there are so many you can refer from last year. We are 18 months into this pandemic. And apart from a few handful of drugs, there are not many that you can knock on to say, yes, use this and this will cure you. And this is why vaccine still remains the most effective public health strategy. And of course, there are issues with vaccination too, and how you get the supply, how you manage to get the maximum coverage, the portfolios that allow the mitigations against variants of concerns. So there's a whole thing out there that sometimes it's not easily articulated in the social media. And this is why this continued process of trying to get it done. Yes.
No, I will completely hear you, and I think you did a wonderful job of explaining it. But if I may just kind of grab the bull by its horns and discuss specifically with ivermectin, which has created so much debate. Dr. Kala, what is the evidence-based approach that Malaysia is taking towards ivermectin?
All right, thank you, Malaysia. Again, I think ivermectin, just like many other repurposed drugs, I mean, they are well-intended, of course. There are laboratory work that indicate that it does have an effect on the SARS-CoV virus. There are cases and key series of cases by well-intended clinicians who've reported that. But also there's the other side where through trials, they have demonstrated that perhaps it's not as what it claims. And this is the problem with the ivermectin divide. You have both sides that claim that, you know, there is effectiveness and non-efficacy. Now, to have an evidence-based trial, you need to have a protocol ready. You need to understand what are your primary objectives or primary aims. So in Malaysia, we have undertaken one such trial, and this is to look at those who benefit from the ivermectin, if it does work. Essentially, it is to target those who are highest risk of deterioration. We know from our clinical characterization work that those above 50 years of age and those with comorbidities, typically hypertension, diabetes, obesity, hypercholesterolemia, they have the highest risk of the worst outcomes from COVID-19. In fact, from the reported death, almost 88% of them come from this category. So if ivermectin is to be beneficial, it should benefit this group most. And so we have included this as a component to determine, does the ivermectin, the use of it, reduces the risk of them deteriorating further or improve their recovery. And we looked at a decent sample size. We have multi sites in the study, and they're in the rollout. We've got the clinicians who are infectious disease clinicians, physicians involved. We monitor the data separately so that there's no biasness to the study. And it is through an informed consent process. And so we hope to have the results real soon because, of course, we have a rapid increase in the number of admissions. And so enrollment is much faster. We're almost near the midway phase. And so there will be some interim analysis, at least on the safety, and we'll see how we go. We're also sharing this data, of course. We have registered in the clinicaltrials.gov. And this is very important, Melissa. I think something that perhaps we need to make public understand. In research, if you make your primary objectives public early on, before you start the trial, people can look at the outcome at the end of the study. Many of the ivermectin study did not have that in place. It's rather looking backwards, observing the results and trying to figure out this helped in certain circumstances and bringing that narrative across being effectiveness. So it is important in trials to make that obvious from the beginning in the onset.
Thank you so much for shedding light into this important matter. That was our conversation with Dr. Kalaira Supariswamy of the Institute for Clinical Research, wrapping up our episode of Consider This. But before we leave you tonight, just a reminder that you can get all the latest information on COVID-19 vaccines at astroawani.com as well as the Astro Awani app. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching the show. Good night.